Welcome to the webinar, Under the Pump, the Impact of Oil Market Volatility. And thank you very much for joining us. My name is Professor Stuart Coles. I'm Professor of Sustainable Materials and Manufacturing and the Associate Dean of Research at WMG at the University of Warwick. And I'm really delighted and excited to be hosting this conversation. I've been looking forward to this for a little while now since we've been doing the panel preparation. For those who may be listening in, I would describe myself as a white male in their mid-40s, wearing glasses and a white t-shirt because it's a little bit warm today here in the UK. I will allow the panelists to introduce themselves and we'll continue the discussion in just a minute. But let me just sort of set the scene around today's discussion first. The alumni community that we have here at Warwick is more than 310,000 worldwide. And it's an incredible global community like no other that I've come across. I consider myself as one, as I'm an alumni as well as a member of staff. And sustainability itself is a pillar of the university's 2030 strategy, and we offer a number of related master's programs at Warwick, including a new MSc in renewable energy that's going to begin in 2027. And we'll share some more information with these programs with you after the event. Now, the Institute for Sustainable Materials and Manufacturing at Warwick is part of that, and the university's ambitious Set the Pace program, which aims to raise somewhere in the region of 250 million to inspire 20,000 acts of volunteering to help address some of the world's most pressing challenges. And as part of that, we're going to examine today the critical role that alternative materials, sustainable practice, investment in cutting-edge research can play in shaping a more resilient future. And we're going to consider how innovation can help alleviate some of the challenges, some of the concerns that are posed by certainly by rising energy costs and the requirements that we need to consider within sustainable manufacturing. So our guests today on the panel, we have three speakers who are joining us. I'm going to ask them to say a few words about themselves, including a physical description for anyone who might be helpful listening in. And I'm going to start with Dr. Russ Hall. Russ.
Hello, I hope everyone can hear me. My name is Dr. Ross Hall. I am the lead for sustainable manufacturing and circular economy for Warwick Manufacturing Group, and I have been until recently the lead for industrial sustainability for the high value manufacturing Catapult and all of its six centres. My work mostly revolves around doing anything I can to help UK manufacturers to decarbonise. That includes the impacts of energy costs, that includes the impacts of new technology, that includes skills. It's quite a broad role. I suppose that leads me to describe myself as a jack of all trades and a master of none, surrounded by some wonderful experts who feed me all of the useful information. A physical description: I am a white male, mid-40s, close-cropped hair, and I'm wearing a blue striped polo shirt today.
Thank you, Russ. I'll now pass on to one of our external panelists, Joe Holt. Joe.
Hi, thank you, Stuart, and very happy to be here with you today. I'm a female in my late 40s. I have light brown and grey hair worn up in a ponytail. I'm wearing a white top and dark glasses. I'm a very happy engineering graduate from Warwick, and after graduating, I spent 15 years working across banking, technical consultancy, and within the large corporate environment. 11 years ago, I co-founded the Everose business with my colleagues. We are a technical consultancy specializing in renewable energy and storage, all at utility scale or large portfolios of domestic projects. And we work from early stage developments right through to the end of project life. And that's from small scale solar projects, for example, costing maybe 25 million, up to projects like the one in the background, multi-billion investments in offshore wind farms. So a very fun, diverse view across that whole sector. Great to see you all.
Thank you very much, Joe. And finally, joining us on the panel, another member of staff here at the university, Deeksha Sampath. Deeksha, could you give us an introduction, please?
Hi everyone, I'm Deeksha. Physical description: I'm female, I'm in my late 20s, I go by she, her pronouns. I have long black hair and I'm wearing a blue top. which is sleeveless because it's really hot today. I work as a technology transfer engineer at the WMG SME Group. My background is in manufacturing engineering, and over the last 5 years, I've supported innovation and resource efficiency projects for industry, but particularly for SMEs, both across the Midlands and nationally. Prior to joining WMG as a young graduate, I spent a year working in steel manufacturing in India, which is where I'm from. So I'm really looking forward to contributing my perspectives to today's discussion.
Thank you very much. And thank you all to be giving your time to be here and joining us today on the panel. I'd also like to thank everybody who's taken the time to submit questions as well. We have kind of synthesized a list of questions that we'll put to the panel based on what was put in. We'll try and cover as many as we can, but obviously the discussion we're expecting to have is going to be quite interesting and long-ranging, so we might not quite get through everything that has been put toward us today, and we have tried to group together the questions to general themes as well. So I'm going to start, and I'm going to pose the first question, and if I can, I'm going to start with you, Deeksha. Oil market volatility has historically been cyclical in nature, and it is driven by lots of key events. What's different now that makes the alternative so important?
Great question. So I think historically, SMEs, from an SME perspective, SMEs have had to ride out the wave, looking at just strapping on and getting on with work, hoping that things will fall into place. But I think what has really changed now is sustainability is no longer a nice to have. It's become an operational requirement. Through my work with SMEs, we're seeing sustainability and resilience increasingly become interconnected as topics. So businesses are exploring alternatives not only to reduce emissions, but also to kind of reduce exposure to future volatility. And the conversation has now kind of shifted from how do we respond to this disruption to how do we build a more resilient and competitive business for the future?
And Joe, do you see resilience and security now sort of being sort of core drivers in this area?
Absolutely. And they always have been, and probably coming through with a different bias at different times. Certainly, the first oil crisis that kicked off the whole renewable energy industry as a viable commercial industry was very much driven by security. The discussion around sustainability hadn't really even featured quite so highly in markets at that time, but it was around security of supply. When we got to more recent oil shocks, like the prices going up after the Ukraine invasion started, the conversation had very much moved away from security and into both sustainability and cost. And it's pretty incredible over the time, talking about from the 70s to today, but it really from the late 90s, early 2000s to today, the industry has been able to deliver cost reduction in clean, sustainable electricity to the point where cost is now the major driver. So renewables now are the cheapest form of new electricity that you can put onto the system. So that real change has been a backdrop, allowing the sustainability goals to be met. There are interesting drivers within that, as to what impact that has on the generators and the producers. So we can follow up on that if that's of interest. But certainly happy to hand back and extend that discussion if helpful.
Russ, I'll come to you now. It feels that with some of the words that both Deeksha and Joe said, that this is now not necessarily cyclical, but more systemic in terms of the way things are transitioning and how we think about the way energy and oil markets are used now.
Yeah, I think there were a lot of comparisons to be made to biggest, more wider supply chain shocks. So the difference between now and perhaps 20, 30 years ago is not just that we are seeing a cyclical oil and gas market. What we're also seeing is supply chain shocks for energy be happening more often. It's exposing different parts of supply chain problems. So If we look at what happened during COVID, what happened during when we had the problems with the Suez Canal, they weren't energy shocks, they were supply chain shocks. What that does by its very nature is expose countries like the UK and companies in the UK to very wide shocks to geopolitical issues by the very nature just drive that kind of exposure. To add to what Joe and Deeksha have said, one of the other differences now is that 20 years ago, there weren't any real viable options to 30 years ago to generating energy by any other means than burning fossil fuels. Well, now there are. And Joe was just talking about that very thing. So we can deploy renewable energy at a domestic level, at a regional level, and at a national level in a way that we never could before. And it's really interesting in the policy space because what we are seeing is a change from discussions around decarbonisation, from around net zero, to stability, to resilience, to price. How do we get the cheapest energy onto the system, and how do we get the energy to work for us? We're seeing changes in the visions of what power networks need to look like. And that will extend to some of the questions that I know are coming later on. When you add all of that up, it is a completely different picture to what we were talking about 30 or 40 years ago. When, I mean, I was a teenager then, obviously, but when you think about those times, for my parents, there was no alternative to oil and gas. For us, this is a very different world.
Thanks very much, Russ. And just to, I'll throw this one as a quick one open to the whole panel. And there's been a lot of talk about risk and resilience, but also the economic impacts. Does any what do we feel is still the dominant driver? Are we still dominated by cost, or is risk and resilience becoming, or is taking that primary position?
Joe.
From my perspective, the dominant factor is still cost. There is much more focus on the cost to the end consumer, the cost of running the national networks, than there is. It's maybe not taken for granted, but it is certainly there on the background, the topic of resilience and security of supply. But from everything I see, it's very much a topic of cost. Can I add a little bit on Russell's points? Because we had an interesting dynamic and the differences between the exposure to oil and gas and the exposure to risk and market fluctuations in the renewable world. Because if you have if you're getting your energy from oil and gas, you're probably going out and hedging your costs on a reasonably short-term basis. You might be buying out 1 or 2 years ahead and fixing your costs. When you are a renewable generator, you sometimes have the option to fix your pricing for 15 years. So that's a fundamentally different way of managing that volatility as well. And another reason why renewables projects, because they're quite CapEx intensive upfront, and once they're operating, you don't have to pay for the wind or for the solar input. That lack of volatility in their long-term operating profiles can be particularly helpful. Interestingly, in the current setup we have here in the UK, we aren't decoupled from it. Electricity pricing and the pricing that is paid for renewable generation is still impacted by the cost of gas. So we are still impacted by that short-term volatility, but that's really a market mechanism, not a fundamental part of the industry, and probably likely to change in the years ahead.
At a company level, when I'm talking to businesses who want to decarbonize, want to change their processes, want to know more about the future of energy systems, it's cost that's the driver. So what they want to know is, and the reason, one of the reasons for exposure in the manufacturing world, they want to know what their alternatives are if they're going to decarbonize. Typically, that conversation will turn to electrification. Electricity, industrial electricity in the UK is arguably the most expensive in the world. So if we want people to decarbonize, what we need to be able to do is put very, very cheap electrons onto the grid in very large supply for that to happen. We can't do that at the moment because gas prices are roughly a quarter of that of industrial gas prices are roughly a quarter of that of industrial electricity in the UK. So to get people to make the shift, they're just not going to do it at a cost level.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, Russ. So, when I've supported companies with grant applications previously, the major driver has been return on investment. So, yes, they want to decarbonize, but what value is it giving them longer term in terms of cost returns and cost benefits as well?
Just to pick up on, there's a point that's come up in the chat, and it's something that Joe mentioned as well. There is a connection between through the mechanism called marginal pricing, which connects gas prices and electricity prices. So if we have a shock in the oil and gas world for fossil fuels, we therefore have an increase in electricity pricing because of how marginal pricing works. We don't have time here for me to explain it. But if there were not, and I don't mean that in a patronizing way, I mean it would take the rest of the webinar to get the full explanation out. The one of the things that we are really pushing for is market reform. We need to see that. And there is a generational difference between people who are my parents' age and people who are much younger, in that they don't under the younger generations don't understand why marginal pricing is still a thing, why that still exists. Again, you look at my parents' world. The only way of getting that electrical energy was by burning fossil fuels. The world has changed. It is changing. It won't be easy, and it will be expensive to make the transition, but boy, will it be worth it when it comes.
Well, I think we'll move on to our next question from there, because I think if we get into the marginal pricing debate, we could be, as Russ said, we could be here for some time. But you've all touched a little bit on sort of sectors and industries there, and so aside from consumers, because we know the sort of like the impact that volatility of prices has on the consumers. What about the sectors that are most vulnerable, or perhaps even what sectors are most resilient towards oil market volatility? Russ, I'll come to you first on this one.
So I'm not going to go down a sector route, sorry, because sectors to me implies automotive, aerospace, etc. I'm going to talk about, I will split it into sectors around who uses the most energy. So for me, it's anybody who's probably got a high heat processor will qualify as an energy intensive industry. To do that in the UK right now, you have to burn fossil fuels to make that happen. You don't have to, but you probably are, rather. Let me phrase it like that. If you're doing that, you're directly exposed to these problems straight away. Your prices will go up and down. And you can hedge for it all you want. But at the end of the day, those prices will change. They will fluctuate with supply chain shocks, and you will feel those problems. And of course, in a more broad sense, if fuel prices go up, the costs get passed on to the customer. We have to move things around the country. We have logistics. That's just a reality. The fuel for that, if it goes up, it's passed on to the customer. It's not kept with the, not necessarily kept with the logistics companies.
Deeksha, maybe get a view from the SME world. How exposed are SMEs in terms of resiliency here?
I agree with Russ that the ones that are more vulnerable, without going into sectors, would be industries that are energy intensive. I would say manufacturing is quite vulnerable as a whole, because you look at energy use, you look at materials, you look at logistics and transport. So all of them, there's impact that is felt by all of those areas. And obviously a little bit of statistic, I'm sure most of you know that within the UK, 99% of manufacturing businesses are SMEs. And so I think the ones that are vulnerable, even within manufacturing as a sector, are tier two and tier three suppliers and SMEs, because the messaging is they do get the pressures from the bigger company because they sit in the middle of the supply chain, but they more often than not don't have resources or dedicated sustainability or energy teams that are looking after how to address these challenges. So I think there's a gap there, which is where RTOs would ideally sit. But I think tier two and tier three companies in the supply chain are quite vulnerable.
And Joe, maybe flipping it around, what about the resilience or organizations? Who is making this work now?
Don't know if anyone's fully cracked it yet, but again, sticking with the examples rather than the sector theme, I think a really interesting one is the data center industry, because it's new for us. And it illustrates nicely a point that was made in the chat around the need to keep up with infrastructure build out. So the infrastructure that we had in the UK for an oil and gas built system made certain assumptions around where power needed to be generated and carried to. And that is all being upended with the energy transition. When that was built, it hadn't anticipated massive volumes of cheap wind power being generated in Scotland and taken down to the south. And this is where other industries and industrial clusters are coming in, and government policy is looking at how it can make it more attractive to take load up north, and these sorts of questions. So the infrastructure one is relevant, but it's always important to look at the big picture and to look at the wider infrastructure investment that the country needs to make to have a whole system that is fit for the future. And these things are always relative. So it's not a case of looking at the infrastructure needed just to transport that wind power or whatever the renewable generation might be around the country. But it's relative to the spend that would be needed to maintain and the cost that would be needed to keep an oil and gas fleet going into the long term with rising costs and rising risks. The cost of managing the environmental infrastructure needed to manage the impacts of climate change. So it goes back to a point I think that Russell was making before about the systematic nature of this. It's very hard to look at one little bit in isolation. And that's what the data center industry is having to do now when it's deciding where should it be located? How does it optimize its location, its access to grid, its access to renewable generation in order to build the resilience it needs? So that's it's a great example right now, and AI conferences, data center conferences happening now on a daily basis tackling this very topic.
I think the we'll touch a little bit upon AI and some of those issues a little bit later on. But it certainly sounds there, Joe, like you're suggesting that the way in which the economy is shaping is changing. There's lots of different things moving on. And as a result, the way in which universities should be teaching people should be preparing graduates in a slightly different way for this sort of energy transition. So Joe, I want to come to you on this because you're obviously not part of the university. So what's your view on what a university should be doing to prepare graduates for the new economy, as it were?
It's absolutely this systematic part of the question. When I graduated, I had the luxury of being able to go into an engineering profession with my engineering skills and spend a bit of time focusing on engineering, and probably spent the first 10 years of my career doing that. These days, as an engineer, I probably spend less than 5% of my time worrying about engineering topics. It's very much more commercial. I get involved everything from the policy side of things to the legal side of things. And probably about 40, 50% of what I do is now commercial in nature. So being able to teach people those core engineering skills or whatever the topic might be, but letting people leave university with some exposure to these other fields around, I think is important, because I don't think we will have the luxury in the future of being able to do single focus. We don't need to know how to design more wind turbines. We need to know how to integrate those with storage in a commercially viable way, with good legal offtake structures, and people that can get their heads around all of that will be critical in the future.
Russ, particularly from the university perspective, what do you think that the university should be doing to help get graduates ready?
So I have the advantage of working at the university but not having to teach. So I'm going to answer the question from a should perspective, not what we're doing. From a should perspective, before I came to the university, I was an engineer and I worked for companies. The company I worked for that everyone's heard of is Rolls-Royce. What's important, and the reason why I mentioned that, is that it's important that you bring those real-world learnings into teaching. I think it's really important that students, as they are coming through the engineering system, through whatever career they are choosing, get exposure to the real world so they can understand the problems. And there are definite advantages to that. It gives you much better appreciation, as Joe was saying, of the system of systems. So you make a decision at point A, it will have an impact at point E and then at point F, and as it goes all the way through the system. Right? That is hugely important. Learning how to understand consequences. But importantly, I think employers need to take graduates from places like the University of Warwick that can hit the ground running. And by having exposure to real world problems in real manufacturing institutions, real renewable power deployment institutions, working alongside getting work experience for people like Joe gives employers an advantage when they get those graduates. That for me, along with teaching really, really good basics, gives me someone who is hugely employable straight away. That's what I think universities should do.
And Deeksha, that context is hugely important, isn't it?
Yeah, I completely agree. So echoing exactly what Joe and Ross have both mentioned, and from having been a graduate in the past myself, only when I started working in industry, I understood the impact of all the different things I studied coming together. Because like Ross rightly mentioned, something starting at point A can have an impact point at point E. So I think the way I look at curriculum developing, it looks like it needs to be more of a multidisciplinary approach, which I see is already happening in a lot of areas. So I think context and understanding, not just teaching the technology itself, but teaching them why it matters and how to deploy that into industry, is essential.
And that sort of deployment is really, really quite critical. And how sort of like the university engages with industry to get there. What, you know, particularly what is Warwick doing in this space to help industry reach net zero? And I'll go to Deeksha first here to come back on this, but. You know, universities don't just teach unpublished papers. There's a lot more than that, isn't there?
Completely agree. So I sit on the SME engagement part of Warwick, which I've already previously mentioned. So the way I look at it with my work with SMEs, particularly in sustainability, from a grassroots level, some of the things that we've tried to do, the overarching theme is looking at a company's broader sustainability goals and looking at a practical way to tailor it to their roadmap or their sustainability ambitions. So the way I see it, I've got three main buckets that I've been supporting on. So the first one is essentially we created Net Zero Innovation Network, which is a group of experts within the SME team, but obviously drawing in from the research groups and your expertise, going into SMEs and sharing best practices. Because sustainability, from what I understand with SMEs, is quite jargon heavy for them, so they don't quite know where to start. And also, there's not been consistent policy around sustainability over the past couple of years, so they do struggle. So that's one of the things we help with, sharing best practices. The second bit is supporting them with grant applications. A lot of the work that I've done is looking at helping SMEs access grants to energy efficient equipment, or looking at other ways to decarbonize, looking at renewables, which has been a big part as well. And we know the benefits of it, as Joe's mentioned as well. So that's one of the things. And I'd say the third thing that we've done is just blue sky thinking, because at the end of the day, we are a university. So looking at innovative approaches. So I've worked on certain projects which are waste heat recovery, for example, and a lot of SMEs or businesses might not actually consider that as one of the options to look at when it comes to decarbonizing. You could just take waste heat recovery, look at doing some simulation, transferring it to another room, and you don't need heating in that room, so you're saving on energy bills. So looking at practical, but looking at feasibility studies and more innovation. So that's another chunk where we do some work.
And Russ, how about the from your perspective, looking at possibly the larger side of the industries?
So WMG supports industries to decarbonize, to be more sustainable through really three main routes. And I think Deeksha's covered one of the most important ones, which is around carbon literacy. It's around environmental literacy. So it's simplifying the problem. The problem, human beings have a wonderful temptation to overcomplicate things. And our job is to act as a translator. And I think we do that very well. One of the big areas where my team and your team, Stuart, work really hard is to show companies how they can account for their emissions, whether it's at a product level or at a business level. We've been working very hard on getting them to understand how you can standardize those practices, how you can optimize it, how you can make it quicker. Why do we do that? Because if you can produce low carbon products in this world, then you have a competitive advantage. And there is a reason for doing it. And I think the way that we WMG works to translate the reason why you should decarbonize or why it's important into industrial languages, we don't start with trying to say we're here to save the world. What we start with is we're here to make sure your company is still here tomorrow, and ideally it's growing. And you can do that and have the two things at the same time. And really for us, I think industrial decarbonisation is an industrial strategy. The two things go hand in hand, which leads me to pillar three. And pillar three is the thing that I never thought I would do, is that not only do I get to sit and be part of webinars like this, but I get to advise the government and we get to influence how policy changes to make sure that manufacturers, industry in the UK can benefit from the changes as they go. That for me, I think, is a really, really important part of what Warwick Manufacturing Group does. And it's something we should be very proud of. We get to make a difference at a national level.
And Joe, both Russ and Deeksha have sort of highlighted about sort of skills, language, terminologies, some of the words there. The education pathways that universities deliver is really critical for business, isn't it?
It was for mine. So if I hadn't been able to find the degree I did when I was going through university, then Everose might not exist. So yeah, those pathways are critical to make sure that engineers, lawyers, business analysts are there and following the pathways through to the industries that we need for the future. I think what I would add to the great discussion around what Warwick is doing is about continuing to build the external links. I think it's very difficult for engineers coming out of university with not having, if you've not been out in the workplace, not understood the wealth of jobs out there. You don't understand for every job that you think exists, there are probably 100 there in the background that you never even imagined. And just even trying to understand what the opportunities are, how to access them. We know it's competitive, we know it's difficult. So the more that businesses can be engaged with these pathways before people even leave university, whether that's through things like WMG, whether it's through research, whether it's through work placements, but just would always encourage the university to maintain those networks and encourage students to build networks out there with people who are delivering the solutions out there in the private world.
I would hope that webinars like this are exactly the sort of thing that helps continue that conversation with alumni, with businesses, etc. And you made a point there, Joe, around sort of like the businesses and how jobs are sort of changing, and we're sort of starting to see the new things. And that almost brings us back to the discussion that we had just a moment ago, where AI was sort of put in, and some of the aspects around artificial intelligence and where that's starting to play a role. And that obviously is new jobs and new systems that are being deployed now in industries up and down the country and all over the world. Maybe Russ to come in on this one first. How can AI in manufacturing be effectively harnessed whilst trying to balance the environmental impact of AI use, particularly around data centers? Is AI the solution or part of the problem?
Should all of the above. At a data center level, data centers are unlocking a whole new type of electrical energy user. So to give some kind of comparison, there's a foundry in Coventry which is the equivalent in energy usage of about 73,000 cafes. A data center, a medium-sized data center, is the equivalent of three or four of those foundries. So they are a whole new type of energy user and energy consumer. But the good news is that it is mostly electrical energy, and most of that electrical energy can be provided from renewable sources. And as we get more and more distributed grids and we get better at things like energy storage, there is a point in the chat around energy storage. It's a really important point. We aren't there yet at grid scale. But as we start to get there, actually, a lot of data centers, well, they're already green. Maybe not in terms of embodied emissions of the materials what's used to build them, but in terms of their operation, they can be very green. And we can make them greener. So they're actually an opportunity because One thing that data centers have got is something that Deeksha was talking about. Data centers have got lots of wasted heat. And currently what we do with that wasted heat is we provide lots of cooling water to cool it. But actually, if you were to use a heat pump in a data center and you were to boost that waste heat, well, there's community heating all of a sudden. So instead of fearing the data center and what it could do, well, perhaps we should look at it as an opportunity to the future for how we can build on it for things like community heating. And of course, like the other side of it is AI at the moment, until we get to things like super intelligence and whatever those things mean, where I am not an expert. What it really does at the moment is it means that we can speed up R&D processes, we can speed up deployment processes. So actually, AI as a way of improving manufacturing processes should be very powerful, and it should enable manufacturers to become cleaner in their operations much more quickly. It's not the devil, but it's not yet an angel either.
So it certainly has a role to play, it seems. And with that sort of the amount of energy consumption that these sort of centers have got, they're like you said, they're almost a different type of energy user. So perhaps, Joe, how does that work in terms of the flexibility that you see from that energy system side? Where does the AI and the data centers fit in there?
I'm not sure they do fit yet. I think it's still being figured out. The system is still needing to, as Russell alluded to, manage the intermittency of renewables. A lot of solar in the UK and lots of countries around Europe and elsewhere that have a peak of output at midday. And data centers are not the answer to that. They do not just want power between midday and 2 p.m. in the afternoon. And I think there's an important point in here. Russell again has used the word should, and we've talked about resilience. And I think some of these topics drive the industry to the musts. And you move beyond resilience almost to survival. And these days, if you are looking to build, if you are a solar developer, if you are looking to build more solar in the UK, and we still need more generation, but you want to make it work despite the fact there's now a lot of solar farms all exporting power at the same time of day, you might need to start building in that storage to survive, for your project to be economically feasible. So, with a lot of these things, we have to remember there is a market mechanic that works, pricing works. And when the value that you can get for your green solar electrons collapses, because there's too much there on the system, there is an investment driver, to put money into renewables. And hence, lots of the companies that are in the sector work across multiple sectors. It's why a lot of people who are in data centers, are also very keenly and have been tied in for a very long time, to the renewable energy world, as well as areas like carbon credits and carbon storage. So these worlds are already quite integrated and interrelated. And again, go back to that, there's a lot of very interesting commercial mechanics there in the background that are either making it work or starting to look promising.
Deeksha, have you got anything to add on this sort of the AI side?
I'm in consensus with what Joe and Russ have both discussed. I think one of the things I'd like to add is we're currently looking at AI from a Gen AI lens, which is, fair given that it's at the, most advanced stage. We're looking to advance that technology more. But if we look at traditional manufacturing, some of the AI that has helped manufacturers more is, for example, looking at predictive maintenance using AI in that, looking at quality checks using AI in that. So I've firsthand been able to see the benefit of what these kind of AI technologies have been able to do for manufacturers. And when it comes to actually looking at their footprint, it's quite lower than what maybe a large language model would be. So I think one of the things I'd like to say is, as AI becomes more accessible, Gen AI or the existing other tools that AI is, organizations need to be more, I'd say, disciplined about how it's deployed. So, yes, we should absolutely be exploring its potential, but there also needs to be appropriate governance and incentives for responsible adoption so that we can balance the measurable operational, commercial, and sustainability benefits altogether.
Moving on then, to sort of continuing on the sort of future theme. Joe, I'll come to you first on this. What, in your view, are the most exciting future alternative energy solutions? Now, in the questions we had, some sectors sort of highlighted automotive or hard to decarbonize sectors, but I'll leave it kind of general. What's the most exciting bit of the future in terms of alternative energy?
I think for me, it's the system enablers. We don't need new forms of generation. We've got that worked out really well. We've got very cheap solar, we've got very cheap wind, for example. Those are still evolving. Solar technology, wind technology get better and bigger all of the time. But that is now well funded and well led by the key suppliers in those areas. What we really need are solutions to address long-term storage. And that could be demand side. It could be something that helps users manage differences in demand. It could be heat recovery point, taking demand off the system to help with that balancing. Or it could be actual storage, physical storage of electrons in some form or convertible energy that helps move beyond the daily cycle into seasonal. And again, there are plenty of these things out there under review. There are plenty that have been out there for a very long time, like hydro solutions, for example. But what we haven't really had to date is the system in place or the systematic thinking or the systematic commercial structures in place to put all of these things together. So another way of looking at it is where is there going to be money to be made in the years ahead? And if I was looking at putting my money somewhere right now, it would be long-term storage.
Russ, it certainly feels then that this is the alternative energy in the future for industry is very much more about deployment and integration.
From an industrial perspective, it's deployment integration, it's flexibility. So to increase resilience, what do you need to do? Ideally, generate all of your own and all of your own energy. If you can do that on site, you're as far away from the national grid as you can possibly be, and therefore you just have control. But that's really difficult, and we're going to need to be able to deploy renewable energy on site much more quickly. But I think the really exciting concepts that are coming forward are how do we get to a resilient grid that is not fully flexible, but as flexible as possible? So I think it's widely recognized that the days of a national grid with six or eight big power stations in the middle of it are gone. Those days are ending, certainly for the UK. What we're starting to see with deployment of renewable energy is distributed systems around the coast, distributed systems in certain areas for wind, as an example. If we were to put more hydro on the grid, that would be distributed in different places. Or how do we do it on a much more local level? So what does the future look like in terms of domestic solar feeding back into the grid, domestic batteries feeding back into the grid, vehicle to X feeding back into the grid, your electric car, Stuart, how does that feed the grid that helps my house, as an example? How do truck fleets integrate into all of that? And what does that look like? How do we have industrial sites? There's a big DHL site that I know in the Black Country that's surrounded by a housing estate. Well, how does they can't use all the electricity they generate? So how do they give it to local communities? How is it shared? How is it given away? That, I think, is a really exciting future in terms of energy generation. And the one related to AI data centers that I'm particularly excited about, SMRs. I want to see how small modular reactors get deployed. If they do, would be lovely. I want to see what the future looks like, and I want to know how that the new technology for SMRs can do things like load following in a way that the big reactors can't. I think we're in a whole new world of generation that is genuinely super exciting for the consumer.
Thank you very much, Russ. We've had a couple of comments in the chat around sort of plastic and sort of its role in terms of sort of fuels and other sorts of materials. Maybe I'll throw this one that's starting off with Deeksha around sort of plastics. Is there a role for plastics within fuel, or what are the more critical questions that are maybe sort of to achieve sustainable sort of plastic management, recycling, etc.
I'll start by saying I'm not a plastics expert, but from an engineering perspective, when I look at technology adoption, some of the critical considerations for me as an engineer would be, do we have enough source? Which for plastics, yes, we do. And then we look at the quality of plastics. We've got different types of plastics, of course, but we're looking at the quality of those plastics and looking at the ways to segregate them. So that would be one of them. The other consideration for me would be pre-processing requirements. Some of them might require a lot of pre-processing, some might require much less. So looking at how we differentiate that between different kinds of plastics. And then finally, we're looking at scalability. So can what's proven in a lab-based environment, looking at is that something that you can scale? Is that something you can move from pilot phase and looking at moving it from, say, TRL 5, 6 to maybe 7, 9? I think that would be the four main considerations I'd have when looking at recycling of any waste stream.
Yeah, certainly it is fair. The one thing I would add, Russ sort of alluded to my team a moment ago, and I'll kind of answer this question. I'll take host prerogatives here a little bit. You can one of the things that we need to consider when we're burning plastic waste and using it for fuel is actually that the emissions that you get from burning plastic waste are very high. They're certainly higher than a lot of traditional fossil fuels because of the efficiencies that you have in terms of these sort of waste to energy plants. So ideally speaking, we don't want necessarily be burning it directly. We don't, converting it to fuel. There's a lot more value in terms of engineering materials to be had by maintaining and keeping it within the system, which does then align with some of our sort of more circular economy principles, trying to maintain value for as long as we possibly can, etc. And that's really where I think the discussion for sort of plastic should be. We shouldn't just try and automatically default to burning it or converting it into something that can be burned. We're trying to utilize some of the alternative solutions that we have elsewhere. I've just got one more question that I'd like to try and fit in briefly. And this one is with a view towards the Warwick's need to be global facing. Yes, we've spoken a lot about UK and some of the aspects around sort of the energy crisis that we've been having here recently. But we also need to have a view from the university of what's going on around the whole world. So how can low-income net oil importers sustainably respond to the energy crisis in their parts of the world? Are there viable alternatives for countries that want to aspire to growth, as we would want to get there, but in the sort of areas such as the global south? Deeksha, maybe come back to you first on this one.
Great question. So, having grown up in India, I've seen firsthand how the landscape for energy transition has very much changed. So, from a long-term perspective, I'd say the biggest thing we need to be focusing on is skills and capacity building. Because yes, we will invest in infrastructure, but unless we have the workforce to back that infrastructure, emerging economies are at the risk of being witness and consumers to the energy transition, then holding their own and being independent that way. So yeah, that's my take.
Joe, how about yourself? What do you see, particularly from a renewables perspective? How are renewables sort of helping solve these issues in Global South?
Well, I've spoken a lot about the UK, but I've spent a good part of my career working across the globe, delivering wind turbines in India, Pakistan, South Africa. My colleagues spend a lot of time deploying solar in places like Morocco, Senegal. It really is a global industry. And if I've, by any way, through constantly referencing the UK, give the impression I only work there, it's absolutely not the case. So the global progress of renewable energy is already massively underway, and we've got great examples already talked about the dominance of wind in places like South Africa. We've got mines who are moving over to renewable energy for all of the reasons that we've been talking about, looking to be off grid with renewables. So that's a really big sector at the minute. We've got Morocco, who's got massive ambitions to become a global player of exporting green ammonia and methanol. India, as Deeksha just mentioned there, has been a massive player in Asian renewables and is the third biggest market, I think, now for solar power. And Latin America also has a massive proportion of its power produced now. So I think the progress is already well moving. There are global councils, there's a lot of global monitoring and partnership and support for this sector. So the best, again, the best way to start isn't to assume that these countries are just getting going, but it is maybe to be tackling all of these systematic issues that we've been talking about in those areas to make sure that the grids are developed, that industry follows, that we've got the policies in place. We've got a good understanding of how to best optimize across that whole system.
Russ, there certainly is a role to play there from both the university's perspective and in that wider area.
Yeah, definitely. And I think to help the countries who need to make the transition and are not as developed, let's say, as perhaps somewhere like the UK is, we have a responsibility to help with that transition. And or there is no one single solution to replacing oil. And as both Joe and Deeksha have said, there is a different solution in different places. We need to help those countries to build the skills, to build the literacy, to build the understanding, and to build the right technologies in the right places. My team is working with, starting to work with companies in India on solar, as an example. So, but not actually on solar generation, around how you can recycle solar panels. What you can do with those materials and how you can lessen the reliance on particular countries for provision of solar. How do we do that? I actually feel that the developed countries have a responsibility to help in that transition, and it's something the socialist in me says we should be doing for free, I guess. So yeah, that's my perspective on that.
Thanks very much. I'd like to just ask you all very briefly to just come up with a closing statement. So just a one line of where you feel this sort of the summary is for yourselves today of our discussion. Joe, can I start with you on this one, please?
Yeah, I'm just excited. I started off when this whole sector for me was just getting going. I've seen it mature, and there's so much interesting development out there. And I think both industry, educational organizations have such an opportunity to get involved in evolving many, many new things. So for me, it's a really exciting place to be.
Russ.
It's really easy to be dragged down by the news and the politics and the trouble and all of everything that's associated with this. But actually, we should be optimistic. The fact we're here having this conversation is good, right? The fact that we've got so many people joining us to hear about this, perhaps driven by political things that are going on around us. But we should be optimistic. The future, if we pursue this, is better for all of us. And going back to what universities should do, they should instill optimism in students and graduates as they're coming out of the university. And people like us who are working in this space, well, we should be optimistic because this is a very, very cool thing to be doing.
Nature.
I think I agree with both Russ and Joe. I'm chuffed that sustainability is becoming more of an important conversation. And like I said previously, it's becoming a more of something we should consider in every decision rather than a nice to have. So I think that's been the highlight while I've been working in industry, is how important it's becoming and looking at how future generations are going to benefit from it. And it's nice to see that there's people who care, people who've joined us today as well. So yeah, just honestly excited is how I'd say I'm feeling.
I think I'll summarize as well from my perspective. I think we've heard today that trying to address our dependency on oil is going to be a very it's going to be a continued journey. There's going to be a lot of innovation, collaboration that's required in order to do it. research going on at Warwick. The university is very proud to be playing a role in that to drive that forward, both locally within the West Midlands, more nationally, and also looking at the global role as well. The big takeaway that I would take across the discussion today is actually it's not just about energy. It's about competitiveness. It's about resilience. It's about redesigning entire systems, having that systems thinking, that critical thinking approach. And if nothing else as well, it's about optimism and hope and promise for the future, which I think is definitely something that we would hope to instill in everyone who we work with at the university, our graduates, all of our stakeholders. I think it's something that, we at Warwick are hugely optimistic about the future. But finally, I'd like to thank the panel, Joe Holt, Russ Hall, Diksha Sampath. Thank you so much for joining us. But also thank you to everybody who's joined and listened to this webinar from across the world. It's been great engaging with you, and I hope to hear from you all again very soon. Thank you.